Welcome to Catspina Music.
Today in this episode, I welcome Dominic Gasparo, and I'm so happy you took the time out tonight to be a part of this. Thank
you. It's good to be here, Kat. Thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
The first thing I'd like to start with is knowing your background, library technician, and also just a writer and a creative spirit. Obviously, and all these things just sort of fuse together, you have a deep affection for history. Mm-hmm. When did that start? When did that come about in your life?
So when I was about, I want to say 11 or so, we did a family vacation to the Adirondacks, in the Lake George area. And we, up there is an area kind of very rich in history, and it's kind of embedded in the history of New York State, which kind of takes it even further than that. And I got to appreciate, you know, there's Fort William Henry and there's Fort Ticonderoga. And so we went to all of these historic sites up there. And I guess that's really where it started. I guess I was about 11. And from that, I got to kind of get into the colonial era of history from there. You know, I got to see, like, you know, the musket demonstrations and all of the reenactors dressed in the colonial garb. So that was kind of the first part of it. And then something really, really awesome happened. I watched the Disney version of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Now, this is very important because it hits on a couple of different things here. Washington Irving wrote that story, and he's kind of known as the America's first man of letters. And here's why I think of that story. It's kind of the perfect storm, because it takes place in 1799. So that's one thing. It involves the history of this area of the Lower Hudson Valley. It involves a figure, Ichabod Crane, taking a era of, you know, the Headless Horseman is a Hessian who fought for the side of the British during the American Revolution, who had a cannonball take his head off. And it's a horror story, which kind of feeds into the creative horror aspect of what I'm into, too. So it's kind of, it takes, and it was, you know, maybe a Halloween or two after I went to Lake George, it kind of takes everything that I was all about and kind of encapsulates it into one beautiful package, so to speak. So it's my favorite story. It kind of encapsulates everything that I'm about, and it inspired me to get the Headless Horseman tattoo on my arm. And it says New York legend, which a lot of people think that I'm boasting about myself, that I'm the New York legend, but it's not. It has to do with, it's a legend born out of New York, even though technically it's really a kind of a retelling of a Germanic legend that Irving kind of transposed to the Hudson Valley, but really it's our legend. It's the first literary accomplishment to come out of the New World. And really that story kind of encompasses everything that I love. It's got a little bit of history. It's got a little bit of horror. It's wholly Dominic Gasparo, if you really want to get
to it. That's incredible. And it's so interesting because as I'm hearing you talk about this, so many things are flashing back. I'm remembering being a bit resistant because I didn't have the best history teachers until I hit about sixth grade. And then I had Mr. Messimer, and he made it so much fun. But that's when we were able to start really going on field trips. Yeah. And then it just makes the idea of really understanding history from that sort of perspective, that tangible perspective. Yes.
Whenever I tell people that, you know, history was my favorite subject, and they always kind of roll their eyes and say, oh my God, I fell asleep. I always tell people, you just weren't taught it properly.
Yes.
I had a great history teacher in seventh grade, Miss Tansman, who took us on a field trip to Philadelphia. And we did an overnight trip to Boston. And really that helped to, that was really like the third and fourth stages of this kind of history obsession that I've kind of been on. And she kind of, she saw that in class I was kind of engaged and I was, you know, really, really absorbing the material. And I remember we were in, I think it was Independence Hall, and she went to the gift shop and she selected like four or five, and she didn't do this to any of the other students. She selected four or five different books and she went, you're going to buy these. These are going to be like for you. You're going to take these home with you. So a lot of it has to do with how it's presented and how it's taught. Because if you have somebody up there that's reading off an overhead, if I don't know how many people remember what overheads are, but they were these awful things that projected up into the front where the teacher's just reading the lecture notes, which can be interesting if it's presented in an interesting way. But if the person isn't passionate about what they're speaking about, then the people on the receiving end aren't going to be receptive to it.
Right. Absolutely. And staying with that for a minute and the idea of education, was that teacher an inspiration for you to pursue this more seriously when you were thinking about your pathway?
So I, for about a good year, I wanted to get my PhD actually for a while. And the teacher two teachers that inspired me to want to do that. One of them is actually still teaching at WCC. His name is Gary Klein. And he actually, the first year that I had gone back to WCC was his first year. He was a young guy at that. This is, we're going back 20 years ago now. So he's been there for quite a while now. And he's still there now. The other teacher at WCC was this man named R.J. Baddeley. And if that's not the most history teacher sounding name that you've ever heard, I really don't know what is.
Exactly.
He walked in. He wore these monochrome suits. He was a heavy set guy. He had a pipe that was unlit, but he always carried this pipe in his hand. And he had a bunch of rolled maps that he would keep under his arm. And he would kind of waddle into the classroom building, and he was a Civil War historian, and he would just go. I mean, and this guy, he taught at WCC for something like 40 years or 30 years or something like that. I had him in the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And again, he brought such a passion and such a panache to when he spoke. It was unbelievable.
Right.
And when I started working for museums in my early 20s and just seeing how other museum professionals, you know, just their temperament and their passion and their they did it for the love of the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I kind of aspired to be. And that's what inspired me to try anyway to take that career path. Yep.
It just makes me think about this piece. I feel, even I try to relay this to my students right now, I grew up and you grew up with that librarian connection, mm-hmm. understanding that they were that source of knowledge to get you that first point of contact, if you will.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, and I'm sure there's so much that has changed, obviously, because of the recent world events and COVID, still with everything needing to be virtual now,
mm-hmm.
but what has been some of the experience with you interacting with the newer generation, the digital natives, if you will, and trying to guide them from somewhat of an old school perspective?
So Neil Gaiman has a great quote about librarians, which says, and it kind of feeds into what you're just alluding to. He says that Google can find you 100,000 answers, and a librarian can find you the right one.
Yeah.
And when I was interviewing I'd interviewed at a bunch of places, I always made sure to drop that into the interview, because I feel that's important. Because, and I feel that in the times that we're living in, a lot of the younger students feel that, what do I need to speak to somebody for? I could just throw it into a search engine, and you know, it'll be right there at my fingertips. But I think that proper searching and, you know, getting to and knowing how to properly sift through a lot of the garbage, and there's a lot of garbage out there, is so important these days.
Yeah.
Because You know, it reminds me of another meme, actually. It's a picture of Abraham Lincoln that says, just because I saw it on the internet, it's true. And then the attributing name underneath it says, like, Thomas Jefferson. So, like, literally everything on it is incorrect. So being able to have a keen eye nowadays is so important, because there's just the amount of information that's out there that needs to be kind of sifted through and vetted and, you know, properly cited, because we do that sort of thing too. You know, how to properly put footnotes and how to properly list your sources and how to do a bibliography and that kind of stuff. You know, you need that one-on-one interaction. So I feel that having that type of relationship with the students is absolutely vital.
Yes. I remember just being so drawn to topics. I was a music therapy major and just learning a little bit more about the history of how music even evolved as a therapeutic art. Mm-hmm. And mathematics and music, I was studying the correlations of how those things intertwined. And, you know, again, it all sort of relates. It just has this echo of my affection for music biographies and history is so vital for us to understand. And I think it's one of the things that we choose to not put enough emphasis on.
One of the great things I feel about, and I my main genre of music that I have been listening to since I was a kid is rock and roll. Yeah. And I feel that rock and roll, and I can't speak for other genres because I dip my toe into other ones too, but I feel that rock and roll, the one thing about it is that there is a kind of an ingrown appreciation for whatever came before it that's within it. So I feel that, okay, so if you grew up in the 80s and you liked Guns N' Roses, well, they always showed an appreciation for Aerosmith. And then Aerosmith always showed an appreciation for the Rolling Stones. And the Rolling Stones always appreciation for the blues. And it always kind of had this kind of linear thing that always went backwards. And I feel that things were never considered, oh, that's old, I'm not going to really listen to that anymore. Yep. Where I feel as some other genres kind of are very quickly to say, oh, you know what, we're not going to even bother with that old stuff anymore. And I feel that definitely in the rock genre anyway, there's always that bit of reverence for whatever, because everything came from somewhere, obviously. Yeah. There's always that reverence that's kind of ingrained in it, which is great.
It's funny, you know, as you even say this, I think about my first album and the reason I chose the title for this podcast. I'm borrowing it from something I've already used, which was my very first album called Engaging the Muse. And I remember thinking that very same thought is it was probably an entire melting pot of sounds, genres, collaborators, musicians, and my first attempt at songwriting. And it made me really think about the things that I was influenced by to try to see what fit. And it was a journey for me because I had, you know, big hopes and dreams to sing like Mariah Carey and be just like that.
Yep.
And it takes a lot of learning, I think, that is, again, we don't take it, you know, for what we see, you know, the American Idol, The Voice, like you just kind of come out and you're a star. It's like, no, there's an evolution there. There's a learning that has to happen.
Another quote, and I'm quoting people left and right.
I love it.
It's what I do. I'm a historian and a writer. Dave Grohl has a great line about, he's kind of very anti-American Idol. He goes, a generation of kids are going to think that that's how you become in a band. And he goes, that's not how it is. Like, you're supposed to, and his exact line is, you're supposed to start out in a garage and suck. That's the way I did it. You know, it's like we used to play in my parents' basement and we were terrible. You know, and God love my parents. You know, they didn't say, you know, I mean, once it got to be like 9 or 10 o'clock, they'd be like, all right, guys, like that's enough. But he's right. You know, it's you don't get famous by, or you don't get good by having people call in or punch in on the internet voting you good. You're supposed to go in a garage or go in a basement and you're supposed to play Nirvana songs terribly for years. And then you get your chops and you get good, you know, like that's how it's supposed to be, you know?
It's so very, very true. And I can understand that paying your dues sort of mentality. So let's transition because I want to talk about what are some of your projects. You mentioned in the beginning, the inspiration that you had from the Adirondacks from a really young age. And I know you just recently got a chance to visit. And in the midst of that, we were talking about some of these new projects. So I'd love to hear about what they are and how you balance your writing regimen into your life.
Yep. So I've got a couple of things. I've got like a stove filled with pots boiling at different levels here. So I'll start with the thing that's at the most completed, and then we'll kind of work backwards.
Sure.
So the thing that's most done and that's most on its way out the door, hopefully, about 10 years ago, I wrote a fictionalized memoir of about a year and a half of a kind of a difficult time that I was going through. I called it The Fools. And right now I'm in the process. I just finished about the 70th version of edits that I had to go through because it's a personal thing. And I wanted to kind of make sure that everything was as in good a place as I could possibly get it. And right now I'm in the process of sending it out to agents. And, I have my Excel spreadsheet, which is very, you know, meticulous. And
I love it.
I've got the name of the agency and the person that I'm querying and their whatever instructions that they gave on the website, whether they wanted 5 pages or a summary or, you know, whatever they're asking for. Yes. And then I have what date I sent it and whether if they've accepted it or they ignored me or whatever that is. So I've got about 30 places and I think I've gotten about 7 or 8 of them out. I hadn't written a really good synopsis. So the ones that haven't asked for a synopsis were the first ones that I sent out. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm in the process of writing a really tight 1 page and trying to boil a 570 page book down to, you know, one page, that's pretty difficult.
Right.
So I had to actually do some research on how to write a good synopsis because I've never really done that before. So yeah, we have The Fools, which is, you know, all the names were changed to protect the guilty. And we were working on that. Then, of course, we have the, I'm trying my hand at nonfiction scholarly work, which is, I'm writing something called A Memory in Stone, which is a scholarly text on gravestone carvers, the men who were, and possibly women, I shouldn't say only men, there could be some women in there, I don't know, I haven't really finished my research yet, but these are the people who were carving gravestones in the 18th century in the Mid-Hudson Valley.
That's incredible.
So yeah, I actually spent yesterday in Columbia County. I visited 3 cemeteries and I got some pretty good information and some good photographs.
Awesome.
And what's funny is that this project actually spurned the next one I'm going to talk about, because in my research for looking for cemeteries in Columbia County, I came across one. It's a very old cemetery, and most of the gravestones in this place date back to, I don't know, early 1800s.
Yeah.
You know, 1822, 1830. But there are these 2 of really young kids that died and were buried in there from like 1997 and like 1993. Wow. And I was like, that's just really strange. Yeah. How did, and why are they among all of these really old tombstones? How did this happen? So that triggered off inspiration for the next piece that I'm writing, which is a, it's going to be a longer novel called The Key to Love and Fear, which is something else that I'm, which is, it's going to be a longer piece, which is going to be kind of a horror novel with some social satire mixed into it.
Great title. I love the title, though.
Yep.
Really good.
It's actually taken from the Youngblood song, Get Together, which is from the 60s. It's a little bit of ripping from that. And I'm also working on the final thing I'm working on, which is kind of, I get to it when I have time, and I'll talk about my schedule.
Yes, please.
After this. This one, I only really work on one day a week. And I'll talk about that in a second. But the last thing that I'm working on is, I call it the Great Loves piece. And I started to think about all of the great romantic relationships that I have been in. Now I'm going to be 39 on Wednesday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. So in those 39 years, I just started to think about all of the women that I have dated, and I was married once. And I just thought about how many of them did I actually love? Mm-hmm. And how many was I actually in love with? And I boiled it down to four. And I decided to kind of do character sketches about what had happened. Surprisingly enough, my wife, ex-wife, didn't make the cut into those four, which a lot of people find interesting. But in doing, you know, a lot of soul searching and a lot of, you know, reflection, you know, in thinking about what had happened and the circumstances, pure emotion and pure, raw, unadulterated, what people consider love, and in its absolute purest form, these four were the ones that I chose to write about. So it's a little bit of a catharsis, I guess, because a couple of them never knew how I felt. Actually, three out of the four never knew how I felt. So I felt that I needed to kind of maybe purge some old demons that needed to kind of, you know, get done. So I kind of feel that it's maybe a cheaper way than going to therapy in a weird kind of a way. So we have that one is the last piece. And what I did was, I guess when the pandemic hit, I subsequently had broken up with somebody who I had been seeing for a while. So I kind of got all this free time. And I guess this creative rush kind of just washed over me. Yeah. And I was like, well, I have all this time, and I have all these things that I want to do. And it was then that I decided, okay, I'm going to make myself a weekly plan. Actually, I have it on my wall right over here.
Yes.
So this is what it kind of looks like. Yeah. You can kind of take a quick look. So I've got, you know, my Sunday, my Sunday, I call it the wild card.
So
whatever I want to do that day, whatever I'm feeling, like if I've neglected one thing, I can kind of jump on that. You know, it's like, well, I haven't worked on this one in a couple of days. Let me double up this week and spend a little more time on that. And then, you know, Monday is my day to work on the gravestone book. And then Tuesday is, now I'm onto the querying agents part of it, but I work on the fools that day. And then Wednesday is the great loves book. Thursday is the key to love and fear. Friday is memory and stone again, and so on and so forth. So what it does is it keeps me accountable. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Virgo, so everything needs to have its place and everything needs to have its kind of order. And if I don't finish it, I'll feel really bad about myself. So I need to kind of, I need to make sure that everything is, that everything gets finished. So, in all honesty, the Great Loves book, I've kind of been slacking off on. I'm not going to lie. If I'm really going to keep myself accountable, I'll be honest about that. But I've been so excited about getting the Fools out there because it's been such a long time coming. I had a relative and his sister-in-law had started this small little boutique publishing house about 3 years ago that it never really went anywhere. And they had actually printed out a couple of copies that would look like if you'd find it in Barnes & Noble. So I do have those to kind of look at every now and then. But I'd really like to see it put out for real. And people have said, have you thought about self-publishing? And I could do that. But for my own sake, I would like to. And I hate to say doing it the right way because that sounds that That sounds a little trite, but I would like to see if an agent would like to pick it up and see if a legitimate publishing house would like to put it out.
It makes me think about just obviously what I go through as a singer and songwriter. You know, we are in a time when we are able to create, mm-hmm. and anybody can do it. And in that case, similar to shifting through all of the clutter in just research, it's the same exact thing with the creative arts, you know, being discovered or becoming a YouTube sensation or becoming like something just going viral, you know, there's no exact formula. And everything that you do is buried. It's underneath. I've got the first 10 years of how I was like that with all of this meticulous planning. And it's how I've built a business on my own. But one of the things my songwriting partner said to me recently, she's like, Kat, you know, you are now hitting your stride, making these recordings, but you've got to do that other piece. You've mm-hmm. got to do that other piece. You got to pitch. And, you know, it's just as I've now transitioned my life and gotten my balance together and needed to feel that groove. Now I'm ready to do the filtering in and making those important scheduling decisions. And it means letting other things go, which is, again, that's been tough for me. But understanding the point of being independent right now and being relationship, not being committed to one, it helps things along too. Yep. And it gives you that freedom to rediscover yourself and your art.
Yep.
And then the other thing, and sort of bringing this full circle, there was one more conversation that we had, and right behind me, right here, is the lyrics or the melody, if you will, sketched out on top to the Rheingold Beer song. And I mentioned to you that my mom was raised by Philip Liebman, who was the owner of Rheingold Beer. And so that was, I think, one of our last conversations about how in my life, there's this wild history of which I've always been so intrigued by. And I just know when I get my mom on this podcast that she will dive into this and how this is just shapes who we are and how we live our lives. And it's just a beautiful journey, I think, that you're on.
Yeah. I mean, my appreciation for or reverence for history kind of even maybe even pre, I mean, yes. I mean, I had that, the trip to Lake George and that, the appreciation for colonial history, New York history, it definitely started there. But even just hearing my friends tell a story, and they make fun of me all the time. Whenever they would be over my house and there would be adults sitting at the table, they would be in the other room playing. And I would always
listen.
I was always at the table listening to them spin tales and spin yarns about people. And they would be like, Dom, what are you doing? We're playing in here. What are you doing in there? And I would just love hearing old family, you know, anecdotes and hearing about relatives that have long since passed away that I never knew about. And it's just, you know, I enjoyed that. I kind of liked being there to kind of absorb all of that. You know, my family's roots aren't here. You know, my dad actually wasn't even born in this country. Mm-hmm. But his dad was, which is kind of interesting. My grandfather was born in Cleveland, then went, you know, then the family went back to Italy. And then my grandfather brought the family back to America in the 50s, which is kind of interesting. But hearing those stories, I enjoyed it. So if you really want to get to the kernel of where that really, really, really began, it may even be there. So you mentioned the family history, and that's what kind of triggered that thought.
As we come to crossroads in our lives, either we can take them and continue on the same path that we're on, or we can dig deeper. Mm-hmm. And it just sounds like to me with the resilience and everything, that's why I wear my dragonfly, created the logo. If I decided to not investigate and I decided to not look at my life or what's influenced it or the world that I'm living, if I didn't take the opportunity to experience that history and learn from it and have it shape my own life, I don't think I would be where I am today.
Yeah, you have to take everything that's kind of happened. And I always tell people I'm more reflective than a mirror. I'm constantly taking stock and thinking about, I mean, maybe too much so, maybe to a fault. And I always say that the problem with me is that I spend so much time looking back that I'm occasionally like walking into walls in front of me because I'm too busy, you know, looking behind. But I feel that it could be dangerous to do the other way, where you're constantly looking forward without taking stock, you know? You know, Mark Twain says that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So, you know, I think it's very important to definitely. And I think that especially if you've gone through stuff, to kind of take a minute and say, man, look at where I am now and look at where I've come from. It's important. You know, especially I've been in a very reflective mood lately anyway, because it's my birthday's coming up in a couple of days. And, you know, it's funny, if you catch me on one day, I'm like, man, you know, I would love to be 10 steps ahead of where I am. And, you know, I get a little bit over anxious and think, man, I wish. But, you know, when you actually take a couple of steps back and you I think to myself, I've actually come a long way, you know, and I've actually accomplished a lot.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Again, from when we first met to now and how we were able to cross paths again and what we could feel with not even needing to say it.
Yeah.
I think we were in a very similar boat and, you know, look what we've done.
Yeah, no, totally. It's great.
It's great. And so wonderful to reconnect this way. Absolutely. I'm inspired by inspired people. I am so happy we had this talk and that you were part of this series. And I know, and I say this to all my guests, I said, there's always going to be a follow-up. I want to know what's happening. And these projects are really evolving. And of course, the next time we'll dive a little bit more into the music side of things.
Yeah, it's a whole other thing. And I said, I think I mentioned for that one, you may need like a 3-hour thing. If I get going, I mean, that's the other thing that this pandemic has allowed me to do is to dig a whole new, because you get tired of listening to the same things over and over again. And there's a whole slew of artists that I've just discovered during this time. It's just like, wow.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other ball of wax.
Can you name one that you
new artist? Phoebe Bridgers.
Phoebe Bridgers. Okay, I'll have to look that up.
Actually, she may be right in your wheelhouse. Okay. Phoebe Bridgers, this band Hopalong from Philadelphia, they're really good. This other band Always, which is spelled with two V's to make the W.
Nice.
And Lana Del Rey, I've got into.
Oh, actually. Yes.
She's. I'm very late to the party on her, but she's very, very, very good.
Yeah, I am too. But it's all good. Dom, thank you for tonight. Thank you.
If you want to learn more about the process, creativity, and the journey, check out my website, catspinamusic.com. Thank you again for listening.